cushion and among the peaks. For work, Nadia hiked down, first through other unpiped and unwired districts like their own, then through those where grid electricity had been installed, and then through those where roads and running water had reached. And from there, she caught a ride on a bus or pickup truck to a place of employment, a food cooperative, in a hastily built commercial zone outside Sausalito. Marin was overwhelmingly poor, all the more so in comparison to the sparkling affluence of San Francisco. But there was nonetheless a spirit of at least intermittent optimism that refused entirely to die in Marin, perhaps because Marin was less violent than most of the places its residents had fled, or because of the view, its position on the edge of a continent overlooking the world's widest ocean, or because of the mix of its people, or its proximity to that realm of giddy technology that stretched down the bay like a bent thumb, ever poised to meet the curved finger of Marin in a slightly squashed gesture that all would be okay. One night, Nadia brought back some weed a co-worker had given her. She did not know how Said would react, and this fact struck her as she hiked home. In the city of their birth, they had smoked joints together with pleasure, but a year had passed since then, and he had changed since then, and perhaps she had changed too, and the distance that had opened between them was such that things once taken for granted could be taken for granted no longer. Said was more melancholic than he had been before, understandably, and also more quiet and devout. She sometimes felt that his praying was not neutral towards her. In fact, she suspected it carried a hint of reproach. Though why she felt this she could not say, for he had never told her to pray, nor berated her for not praying. But in his devotions was ever more devotion, and towards her, it seemed, there was ever less. She had considered rolling a joint outdoors and smoking the weed by herself, without Said, concealed from Said. And it had surprised her to be considering this, and made her wonder about the ways in which she was herself putting barriers between her and him. She did not know if these gaps that had been widening were mostly her doing or his, but she knew she still harbored tenderness for him. And so she had brought the weed home, and it was only when she sat beside him on the car seat they had bartered for and used now as a sofa that she realized, from her nervousness, that how in this moment he responded to the weed was a matter of portentous significance to her. Her leg and arm touched Said's leg and arm, and he was warm to his clothing, and he sat in a way that suggested exhaustion. But he also managed a tired smile, which was encouraging, and when she opened her fist to reveal what was inside, as she had once before done on her rooftop a brief lifetime ago, and he saw the weed, he started to laugh, almost soundlessly, a gentle rumble, and he said, his voice uncoiling like a slow, languid exhalation of marijuana-scented smoke, "Fantastic." Said rolled the joint for them both, Nadia barely containing her jubilation and wanting to hug him but restraining herself. He lit it and they consumed it, lungs burning, and the first thing that struck her was that this weed was much stronger than the hash back home, and she was quite floored by its effects, and also well on her way to becoming a little paranoid and finding it difficult to speak. For a while they sat in silence, the temperature dropping outside. Said fetched a blanket and they bundled it around themselves, and then, not looking at each other, they started to laugh, and Nadia laughed until she cried. In Marin, there were almost no natives, these people having died out or been exterminated long ago, and one would see them only occasionally, at impromptu trading posts, or perhaps more often, but wrapped in clothes and guises and behaviors indistinguishable from anyone else. At the trading posts, they would sell beautiful silver jewelry and soft leather garments and colorful textiles, and the elders among them seemed not infrequently to be possessed of a limitless patience that was matched by a limitless sorrow. Tales were told at these places that people from all over now gathered to hear, for the tales of these natives felt appropriate to this time of migration and gave listeners much-needed sustenance. And yet it was not quite true to say there were almost no natives, nativeness being a relative matter, and many others considered themselves native to this country, by which they meant that they or their parents or their grandparents or the grandparents of their grandparents, had been born on the strip of land that stretched from the mid-northern Pacific to the mid-northern Atlantic, that their existence here did not owe anything to a physical migration that had occurred in their lifetimes. It seemed to say that the people who advocated this position most strongly, who claimed the rights of nativeness most forcefully, tended to be drawn from the ranks of those with light skin who looked most like the natives of Britain. And as had been the case with many of the natives of Britain, many of these people too seemed stunned by what was happening to their homeland, what had already happened in so brief a period, and some seemed angry as well. A third layer of nativeness was composed of those who others thought directly descended, even in the tiniest fraction of their genes, from the human beings who had been brought from Africa to this continent centuries ago as slaves. While this layer of nativeness was not vast in proportion to the rest, it had vast importance, for society had been shaped in reaction to it, and unspeakable violence had occurred in relation to it, and yet it endured, fertile, a stratum of soil that perhaps made possible all future transplanted soils, and to which Sayd in particular was attracted, since at a place of worship where he had gone one Friday, the communal prayer was led by a man who came from this tradition and spoke of this tradition, and Sayd had found, in the weeks he and Nadia had been in Marin, this man's words to be full of soul-soothing wisdom. The preacher was a widower, and his wife had come from the same country as Sayd, and so the preacher knew some of Sayd's language, and his approach to religion was partly familiar to Sayd, while at the same time partly novel too. The preacher did not solely preach. Mainly he worked to feed and shelter his congregants, and to teach them English. He ran a small but efficient organization, staffed with volunteers, young men and women, all Sayd's color or darker, which Sayd too had soon joined. And among these young men and women that Sayd now labored alongside was one woman in particular, the preacher's daughter, with curly hair she wore tied up high on her head with a cloth. This one woman, the one woman in particular that Sayd avoided speaking to, because whenever he looked at her, he felt his breath tighten within him, and he thought guiltily of Nadia. And he thought further that here, for him, lay something best not explored at all. Nadia perceived the presence of this woman not in the form of a distancing by Sayd, as might have been expected, but rather as a warming up and reaching out. Sayd seemed happier and keen to smoke joints with Nadia at the end of the day, or at least share a couple of puffs, for they had adjusted their consumption in recognition of the local weed's potency. And they began to speak of nothings once again, of travel and the stars and the clouds and the music they heard all around them from the other shanties. She felt bits of the old Sayd returning. She wished, therefore, that she could be the old Nadia. But much as she enjoyed their chats and the improved mood between them, they rarely touched, and her desire to be touched by him, long subsided, did not flicker back into flame. It seemed to Nadia that something had gone quiet inside her. She spoke to him, but her words were muffled to her own ears. She lay beside Sayd, falling asleep, but not craving his hands or his mouth on her body, stifled, as if Sayd were becoming her brother, though never having had a brother, she was unsure what that term meant. It was not that her sensuality, her sense of the erotic, had died. She found herself aroused readily by a beautiful man she passed as she walked down to work, by memories of the musician who had been her first lover, by thoughts of the girl from Mykonos. And sometimes, when Sayd was out or asleep, she pleasured herself. And when she pleasured herself, she thought increasingly of that girl, the girl from Mykonos, and the strength of her response no longer surprised her. When Sayd was a child, he had first prayed out of curiosity. He had seen his mother and father praying, and the act held a certain mystery for him. His mother used to pray in her bedroom, perhaps once a day, unless it was a particularly holy time, or there had been a death in the family, or an illness, in which case she prayed more often. His father prayed mainly on Fridays, under normal circumstances, and only sporadically during the week. Sayd would see them preparing to pray, and see them praying, and see their faces after they had prayed, usually smiling, as though relieved, or released, or comforted. And he would wonder what happened when one prayed, and he was curious to experience it for himself, and so he asked to learn before his parents had yet thought of teaching him, and his mother provided the requisite instruction one particularly hot summer, and that is how, for him, it began. Until the end of his days, prayer sometimes reminded Sayed of his mother and his parents' bedroom with its slight smell of perfume and the ceiling fan churning in the heat. As he was entering his teens, Sayed's father asked Sayed if he would like to accompany him to the weekly communal prayer. Sayed said yes, and thereafter every Friday, without fail, Sayed's father would drive home and collect his son, and Sayed would pray with his father and the men, and prayer for him became about being a man, being one of the men, a ritual that connected him to adulthood and to the notion of being a particular sort of man, a gentleman, a gentle man, a man who stood for community and faith and kindness and decency, a man, in other words, like his father. Young men pray for different things, of course, but some young men pray to honor the goodness of the men who raised them, and Sayed was very much a young man of this mold. By the time he entered university, Sayed's parents prayed more often than they had when he was younger, maybe because they had lost a great many loved ones by that age, or maybe because the transient natures of their own lives were gradually becoming less hidden from them, or maybe because they worried for their son in a country that seemed to worship money above all, no matter how much other forms of worship were given lip service, or maybe simply because their personal relationships with prayer had deepened and become more meaningful over the years. Sayed, too, prayed more often in this period, at the very least once a day, and he valued the discipline of it, the fact that it was a code, a promise he had made, and that he stood by. Now, though, in Marin, Sayed prayed even more, several times a day, and he prayed fundamentally as a gesture of love for what had gone and would go and could be loved in no other way. When he prayed, he touched his parents, who could not otherwise be touched, and he touched a feeling that we are all children who lose our parents, all of us, every man and woman and boy and girl, and we too will all be lost by those who come after us and love us. And this loss unites humanity, unites every human being, the temporary nature of our beingness, and our shared sorrow, the heartache we each carry and yet too often refuse to acknowledge in one another. And out of this, Sayed felt it might be possible, in the face of death, to believe in humanity's potential for building a better world. And so he prayed as a lament, as a consolation, and as a hope. But he felt that he could not express this to Nadia, that he did not know how to express this to Nadia, this mystery that prayer linked him to. And it was so important to express it. And somehow, he was able to express it to the preacher's daughter, the first time they had a proper conversation, at a small ceremony he happened upon after work, which turned out to be a remembrance for her mother, who had been from Sayed's country and was prayed for communally on each anniversary of her death. And her daughter, who was also the preacher's daughter, said to Sayed, who was standing near her, "So tell me about my mother's country." And when Sayed spoke, he did not mean to, but he spoke of his own mother, and he spoke for a long time, and the preacher's daughter spoke for a long time. And when they finished speaking, it was already late at night. Sayed and Nadia were loyal, and whatever name they gave their bond, they each in their own way believed it required them to protect the other, and so neither talked much of drifting apart, not wanting to inflict a fear of abandonment, while also themselves quietly feeling that fear, the fear of the severing of their tie, the end of the world they had built together, a world of shared experiences in which no one else would share, and a shared intimate language that was unique to them, and a sense that what they might break was special and likely irreplaceable. But while fear was part of what kept them together, for those first few months in Marin, more powerful than fear was the desire that each see the other find firmer footing before they let go. And thus, in the end, their relationship did, in some senses, come to resemble that of siblings, in that friendship was its strongest element. And unlike many passions, theirs managed to cool slowly, without curdling into its reverse, anger, except intermittently. Of this, in later years, both were glad, and both would also wonder if this meant that they had made a mistake, that if they had but waited and watched, their relationship would have flowered again. And so their memories took on potential, which is, of course, how our greatest nostalgias are born. Jealousy did rear itself in their shanty from time to time, and the couple that was uncoupling did argue, but mostly they granted each other more space, a process that had been ongoing for quite a while. And if there was sorrow and alarm in this, there was relief too, and the relief was stronger. There was also closeness, for the end of a couple is like a death, and the notion of death, of temporariness can remind us of the value of things, which it did for Sayyid and Nadia. And so, even though they spoke less and did less together, they saw each other more, although not more often. One night, one of the tiny drones that kept a watch on their district, part of a swarm and not larger than a hummingbird, crashed into the transparent plastic flap that served as both door and window of their shanty. And Sayyid gathered its motionless iridescent body and showed it to Nadia. And she smiled and said they ought to give it a burial. And they dug a small hole right there in the hilly soil where it had fallen, using a spade, and then covered this grave again, pressed it flat. And Nadia asked if Sayyid was planning on offering a prayer for the departed automaton. And he laughed and said maybe he would. Sometimes they liked to sit outside their shanty in the open air, where they could hear all the sounds of the new settlement, sounds like a festival, music and voices and a motorcycle in the wind, and they wondered what Marin had been like before. People said it had been beautiful, but in a different way, and empty. The winter that year was a season that had splashes of autumn and spring mixed up in it, even an occasional day of summer. Once as they sat, it was so warm that they did not need sweaters, and they watched as the sunlight poured down in angled bursts through gaps in the bright, roiling clouds, and lit up bits of San Francisco and Oakland and the otherwise dark waters of the bay. "What's that?" Nadia asked Sayyid, pointing to a flat and geometric shape. "They called it Treasure Island," Sayyid said. She smiled. "What an interesting name." "Yes. The one behind it should be called Treasure Island. It's more mysterious." Sayyid nodded. "And that bridge, Treasure Bridge." Someone was cooking over an open fire nearby, beyond the next ridge of shanties. They could see a thin trail of smoke and smell something. Not meat. Sweet potatoes, maybe. Or maybe plantains. Sayyid hesitated, then took Nadia's hand, his palm covering her knuckles. She curved her fingers, furling the tips of his around hers. She thought she felt his pulse. They sat like that for a long while. "I'm hungry," she said. "So am I." She almost kissed him on his prickly cheek. "Well, somewhere down there is everything in the world anyone could want to eat." Not far to the south, in the town of Palo Alto, lived an old woman who had lived in the same house her entire life. Her parents had brought her to this house when she was born, and her mother had passed on there when she was a teenager, and her father when she was in her 20s, and her husband had joined her there, and her two children had grown up in this house, and she had lived alone with them when she divorced, and later with her second husband, their stepfather, and her children had moved off to college and not returned, and her second husband had died 2 years ago, and throughout this time, she had never moved, traveled, yes, but never moved, and yet it seemed the world had moved, and she barely recognized the town that existed outside her property. The old woman had become a rich woman on paper, the house now worth a fortune, and her children were always pestering her to sell it, saying she didn't need all that space. But she told them to be patient. It would be theirs when she died, which wouldn't be long now. And she said this kindly, to sharpen the bite of it, and to remind them how much they were motivated by money, money they spent without having, which she had never done, always saving for a rainy day, even if only a little. One of her granddaughters went to the great university nearby, a university that had gone from being a local secret to among the world's most famous in the space of the old woman's lifetime. This granddaughter came to see her, often as much as once a week. She was the only one of the old woman's descendants who did this, and the old woman adored her, and also sometimes felt baffled by her. Looking at her granddaughter, she thought she saw what she would have looked like had she been born in China, for the granddaughter had features of the old woman, and yet looked to the old woman, overall, more or less, but mostly more, Chinese. There was a rise that led up to the old woman's street, and when she was a little girl, the old woman used to push her bike up and then get on and zoom back down without pedaling, bikes being heavy in those days and hard to take uphill, especially when you were small, as she was then, and your bike too big, as hers had been. She had liked to see how far she could glide without stopping, flashing through the intersections, ready to brake, but not overly ready, because there had been a lot less traffic, at least as far as she could remember. She had always had carp in a mossy pond in the back of her house, carp that her granddaughter called goldfish, and she had known the names of almost everyone on her street, and most had been there a long time. They were old California, from families that were California families. But over the years, they had changed more and more rapidly, and now she knew none of them, and saw no reason to make the effort, for people bought and sold houses the way they bought and sold stocks. And every year, someone was moving out, and someone was moving in. And now, all these doors, from who knows where, were opening. And all sorts of strange people were around. People who looked more at home than she was, even the homeless ones, who spoke no English. More at home, maybe because they were younger. And when she went out, it seemed to her that she too had migrated, that everyone migrates, even if we stay in the same houses our whole lives, because we can't help it. We are all migrants through time. Chapter 11. All over the world, people were slipping away from where they had been, from once fertile plains cracking with dryness, from seaside villages gasping beneath tidal surges, from overcrowded cities and murderous battlefields, and slipping away from other people too, people they had in some cases loved, as Nadia was slipping away from Said, and Said from Nadia. It was Nadia who first brought up the topic of her moving out of the shanty, said in passing as she sipped on a joint, taking the slenderest of puffs, held in her lungs even as the idea of what she had said scented the air. Said did not say anything in response. He merely took a hit himself, contained it tightly, exhaling later into her exhale. In the morning when she woke, he was looking at her, and he stroked the hair from her face, as he had not done for months. And he said if anyone should leave the home they had built, it was him. But as he said this, he felt he was acting, or if not acting, then so confused as to be incapable of gauging his own sincerity. He did think that he ought to be the one to go, that he had reparations to make for becoming close to the preacher's daughter. So it was not his words that felt to him like an act, but rather his stroking of Nadia's hair, which, it seemed to him in that moment, he might never have permission to stroke again. Nadia, too, felt both comforted and discomforted by this physical intimacy, and she said that no, she wanted to be the one to leave if one of them left, and she likewise detected an untruth in her words, for she knew the matter was not one of if, but of when, and that when would be soon. A spoilage had begun to manifest itself in their relationship, and each recognized it would be better to part now, ere worse came. But days passed before they discussed it again, and as they discussed it, Nadia was already packing her things into a backpack and a satchel, and so the discussion of her departure was not, as it pretended to be, a discussion of her departure, but a navigation, through words that said otherwise, of their fear of what would come next. And when Said insisted he would carry her bags for her, she insisted he not do so. And they did not embrace or kiss then. They stood facing each other at the threshold of the shanty that had been theirs, and they did not shake hands either. They looked each at the other for a long, long time, any gesture seeming inadequate. And in silence, Nadia turned and walked away into the misty drizzle, and her raw face was wet and alive. At the food cooperative where Nadia worked, there were rooms available, storerooms upstairs, in the back. These rooms had cots, and workers in good standing at the cooperative could use them, stay there, seemingly indefinitely, provided one's colleagues thought the need to stay was valid, and one put in enough extra hours to cover the occupancy. And while this practice was likely in violation of some code or other, regulations were not much in force anymore, even here near Sausalito. Nadia knew people stayed at the cooperative, but she did not know how the policy worked, and no one had told her. For although she was a woman, and the cooperative was run and staffed predominantly by women, her black robe was thought by many to be off-putting, or self-segregating, or in any case, vaguely menacing. And so, few of her colleagues had really reached out to her, until the day that a pale-skinned, tattooed man had come in while she was working the till and had placed a pistol on the counter and said to her, "So what the fuck do you think of that?" Nadia did not know what to say, and so she said nothing, not challenging his gaze, but not looking away either. Her eyes focused on a spot around his chin, and they stood like this, in silence, for a moment, and the man repeated himself, a bit less steadily the second time. And then, without robbing the cooperative or shooting Nadia, he left, taking his gun and cursing and kicking over a bushel of lumpy apples as he went. Whether it was because they were impressed by her mettle in the face of danger, or because they recalibrated their sense of who was threat and who was threatened, or because they now simply had something to talk about, several people on her shifts began chatting with her a lot more after that. She felt she was beginning to belong, and when one told her about the option of living at the cooperative, and that she could avail herself of it if her family was oppressing her, or, another added quickly, even if she just felt like a change, the possibility struck Nadia with a shock of recognition, as though a door was opening up, a door in this case, shaped like a room. It was into this room that Nadia moved when she separated from Said. The room smelled of potatoes and thyme and mint, and the cot smelled a little of people, even though it was reasonably clean, and there was no record player and no scope to decorate either, the room continuing to be used as a storeroom. But Nadia was nonetheless reminded of her apartment in the city of her birth, which she had loved, reminded of what it was like to live there alone, and while the first night she slept not at all, and the second only fitfully, as the days passed, she slept better and better, and this room came to feel to her like home. The locality around Marin seemed to be rousing itself from a profound and collective low in those days. It has been said that depression is a failure to imagine a plausible, desirable future for oneself, and, not just in Marin, but in the whole region, in the Bay Area, and in many other places too, places both near and far, the apocalypse appeared to have arrived, and yet it was not apocalyptic, which is to say that while the changes were jarring, they were not the end, and life went on, and people found things to do, and ways to be, and people to be with, and plausible, desirable futures began to emerge, unimaginable previously, but not unimaginable now, and the result was something not unlike relief. Indeed, there was a great creative flowering in the region, especially in music. Some were calling this a new jazz age, and one could walk around Marin and see all kinds of ensembles, humans with humans, humans with electronics, dark skin with light skin, with gleaming metal, with matte plastic, computerized music and unamplified music, and even people who wore masks or hid themselves from view. Different types of music gathered different tribes of people, tribes that had not existed before, as is always the case. And at one such gathering, Nadia saw the head cook from the cooperative, a handsome woman with strong arms, and this woman saw Nadia seeing her and nodded in recognition. Later they wound up standing beside one another and talking, not much, and just in between the songs. But when the set ended, they did not leave. They continued to listen and talk during the set that followed. The cook had eyes that seemed an almost inhuman blue, or rather a blue that Nadia had not previously thought of as human, so pale as to suggest, if you looked at them when the cook was looking away, that these eyes might be blind. But when they looked at you, there was no doubt that they saw, for this woman gazed so powerfully, she was such a watcher, that her watching hit you like a physical force, and Nadia felt a thrill being seen by her and seeing her in turn. The cook was, of course, an expert in food, and over the coming weeks and months, she introduced Nadia to all sorts of old cuisines, and to new cuisines that were being born, for many of the world's foods were coming together and being reformed in Marin, and the place was a taster's paradise, and the rationing that was underway meant you were always a little hungry, and therefore primed to savor what you got. And Nadia had never before delighted in tasting as she did in the company of the cook, who reminded her a bit of a cowboy, and who made love, when they made love, with a steady hand and a sure eye and a mouth that did little, but did it so very well. Said and the preacher's daughter likewise drew close, and while there was some resistance by others to this, Said's ancestors not having undergone the experience of slavery and its aftermath on this continent, the effects of the preacher's particular brand of religion diminished this resistance, and with time camaraderie did too, the work Said did alongside his fellow volunteers. And then there was the fact that the preacher had married a woman from Said's country, and also that the preacher's daughter was born of a woman from Said's country, and so the pair's closeness, even if it prompted unease in some quarters, was tolerated. And for the pair themselves, Their closeness carried both a spark of the exotic and the comfort of familiarity, as many couplings do when they first begin. Said would seek her out in the mornings when he arrived for work, and they would talk and smile sidelong, and she might touch his elbow, and they would sit together at the communal lunch, and in the evenings, when their work was done for the day, they would walk through Marin, hike up and down the paths and the streets that were forming, and once they walked past Said's shanty, and he told her it was his, and the next time they walked by, she asked to see the inside of it, and they went in, and they shut the plastic flap behind them. The preacher's daughter found in Said an attitude to faith that intrigued her, and she found the expansiveness of his gaze upon the universe, the way he spoke of the stars and of the people of the world, very sexy, and his touch as well, and she liked the cut of his face, how it reminded her of her mother and hence her childhood. And Said found her remarkably easy to talk to, not just because she listened well or spoke well, which she did, but because she prompted him to want to listen and speak. And he had from the outset found her so attractive that she was almost difficult to look at. And also, though he did not say this to her, or even care to think it, there were aspects of her that were much like Nadia. The preacher's daughter was among the local campaign leaders of the plebiscite movement, which sought a ballot on the question of the creation of a regional assembly for the Bay Area, with members elected on the principle of one person, one vote, regardless of where one came from. How this assembly would coexist with other pre-existing bodies of government was as yet undecided. It might at first have only a moral authority, but that authority could be substantial, for unlike those other entities for which some humans were not human enough to exercise suffrage, this new assembly would speak from the will of all the people, and in the face of that will, it was hoped, greater justice might be less easily denied. One day, she showed Said a little device that looked to him like a thimble. She was so happy, and he asked her why, and she said that this could be the key to the plebiscite, that it made it possible to tell one person from another and ensure they could vote only once, and it was being manufactured in vast numbers, at a cost so small as to be almost nothing, and he held it on his palm and discovered to his surprise that it was no heavier than a feather. When Nadia walked away from their shanty, she and Said did not communicate for the rest of the day, nor on the day that followed. It was the longest cessation of contact between them since they had left the city of their birth. On the evening of their second day apart, Said called her to ask how she was doing, to inquire if she was safe, and also to hear her voice. And the voice he heard was familiar and strange. And as they spoke, he wanted to see her, but he withstood this, and they hung up without arranging a meeting. She called him the following evening, again a brief call, and after that they messaged or spoke to one another on most days, and while their first weekend apart passed separately, on the second weekend they agreed to meet for a walk by the ocean, and they walked to the sound of the wind and the crashing waves and in the hiss of the spray. They met again for a walk the weekend after that, and again the weekend after that, and there was a sadness to these meetings, for they missed each other, and they were lonely and somewhat adrift in this new place. Sometimes after they met, Nadia would feel part of herself torn inside, and sometimes Said would feel this, and both teetered on the cusp of making some physical gesture that would bind them each to the other again, but both in the end managed to resist. The ritual of their weekly walk was interrupted, as such connections are, by the strengthening of other pulls on their time. The pull of the cook on Nadia, of the preacher's daughter on Said, and of new acquaintances. While the first shared weekend walk that they skipped was noticed sharply by them both, the second was not so much, and the third almost not at all, and soon they were meeting only once a month or so, and several days would pass in between a message or a call. They lingered in this state of tangential connection as winter gave way to spring, though seasons in Marin seem sometimes to last only for a small portion of a day, to change in the time that one took off one's jacket or put on one's sweater. And they lingered still in this state as a warm spring gave way to a cool summer. Neither much enjoyed catching unexpected glimpses of their former lover's new existence online, and so they distanced themselves from each other on social networks. And while they wished to look out for each other and to keep tabs on each other, staying in touch took a toll on them, serving as an unsettling reminder of a life not lived. And also they grew less worried each for the other, less worried that the other would need them to be happy. And eventually a month went by without any contact, and then a year, and then a lifetime. Outside Marrakesh, in the hills, overlooking the palatial home of a man who might once have been called a prince, and a woman who might once have been called a foreigner, there was a maid in an emptying village who could not speak, and, perhaps for this reason, could not imagine leaving. She worked in the great house below, a house that had fewer servants now than it did in the year before, and fewer then than in the year before that, its retainers having gradually fled or moved, but not the maid, who rode to work each morning on a bus, and who survived by virtue of her salary. The maid was not old, but her husband and daughter were gone, her husband not long after their marriage, to Europe, from which he had not returned, and from which he had eventually stopped sending money. The maid's mother had said it was because she could not speak, and because she had given him a taste of the pleasures of the flesh, unknown to him before their marriage, and so she had armed him as a man, and had been disarmed by nature as a woman. But her mother had been hard, and the maid had not thought the trade a bad one, for her husband had given her a daughter, and his daughter had given her companionship on her journey through life. And though her daughter, too, had passed through the doors, she returned to visit, and each time she returned, she told the maid to come with her, and the maid said no, for she had a sense of the fragility of things. And she felt she was a small plant in a small patch of soil held between the rocks of a dry and windy place, and she was not wanted by the world, and here she was at least known, and she was tolerated, and that was a blessing. The maid was of an age at which men had stopped seeing her. She had had the body of a woman when she was still a girl, when she was married off, so young, and her body had ripened further after she birthed and nursed her child, and men had once paused to look at her, not at her face, but at her figure, and she had often been alarmed by those looks, in part because of the danger in them, and in part because she knew how they changed when she was revealed to be mute, and so the end of being seen was mostly a relief. Mostly, almost entirely, yet not entirely, for life had given the maid no space for the luxuries of vanity, but even so, she was human. The maid did not know her age, but she knew she was younger than the mistress of the house where she worked, whose hair was still jet, and whose posture was still erect, and whose dresses were still cut with the intention to arouse. The mistress seemed not to have aged at all in the many years the maid had worked for her. From a distance, she might be mistaken for a very young woman, while the maid seemed to have aged doubly, perhaps for them both, as if her occupation had been to age, to exchange the magic of months for banknotes and food. In the summer that Sayyid and Nadia were parting into separate lives, the maid's daughter came to see the maid in that village where almost everyone had gone, and they drank coffee under the evening sky, and looked out at the reddening dust rising in the south, and daughter asked mother again to come with her. The maid looked at her daughter, who looked to her as though she had captured the best of her, and of her husband too, for she could see him in her, and of her mother, whose voice came from her daughter's mouth, strong and low, but not her words, for her daughter's words were utterly unlike her mother's had been. They were quick and nimble and new. The maid placed her hand on her daughter's hand and brought it to her lips and kissed it, the skin of her lips clinging for an instant to the skin of her child, clinging even as she lowered her daughter's hand, the shape of lips being mutable in this way, and the maid smiled and shook her head. One day she might go, she thought, but not today. Chapter 12. Half a century later, Nadia returned for the first time to the city of her birth, where the fires she had witnessed in her youth had burned themselves out long ago, the lives of cities being far more persistent and more gently cyclical than those of people. And the city she found herself in was not a heaven, but it was not a hell, and it was familiar but also unfamiliar. And as she wandered about slowly, exploring, she was informed of the proximity of Sayyid, and after standing motionless for a considerable moment, she communicated with him, and they agreed to meet. They met at a cafe near her old building, which still stood, though most of the others close by had changed, and they sat beside one another on two adjacent sides of a small square table, under the sky, and they looked at each other, sympathetic looks, for time had done what time does, but looks of particular recognition. and they watched the young people of this city pass, young people who had no idea how bad things once were, except what they studied in history, which was perhaps as it should be, and they sipped their coffees, and they spoke. Their conversation navigated two lives, with vital details highlighted and excluded, and it was also a dance, for they were former lovers, and they had not wounded each other so deeply as to have lost their ability to find a rhythm together. And they grew younger and more playful as the coffee in their cups diminished. And Nadia said, "Imagine how different life would be if I had agreed to marry you." And Saeed said, "Imagine how different it would be if I had agreed to have sex with you." And Nadia said, "We were having sex." And Saeed considered and smiled and said, "Yes, I suppose we were." Above them, bright satellites transited in the darkening sky, and the last hawks were returning to the rest of their nests, and around them passers-by did not pause to look at this old woman in her black robe or this old man with his stubble. They finished their coffees. Nadia asked Saeed if he had been to the deserts of Chile and seen the stars, and was it all he had imagined it would be? He nodded and said if she had an evening free, he would take her. It was a sight worth seeing in this life. And she shut her eyes and said she would like that very much. And they rose and embraced and parted, and did not know, then, if that evening would ever come. This is Mohsen Hamid. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Exit West. This program was directed by Kevin Thompson, executive producer Sarah Jaffe, recording engineer Jamal Rahman, recorded at True Brew Records in Lahore, Pakistan. Text copyright 2017 by Mohsen Hamid. Production copyright 2017 Penguin Random House LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.